Good morning, everyone. It is, gonna make sure we're to 9 o'clock. Yes, it is 9 o'clock, December 19th, 2017. I'm Randy Christman, Chairman of the Public Service Commission, and with me are Brian Krosius and Julie Fedorchek, the other two commissioners, although a quorum isn't really an issue here because this is not a meeting, per se, as Public Service Commission meetings go. This is just a sit-down conversation with a company and an interesting situation here. Well, I'll get into that more in some opening comments. We're still waiting on one more staff person to come in, and I believe has just arrived. So before we even start with opening comments or start with a discussion, I'd like to have everyone go around the table and just introduce themselves so we have names and can go about a dialogue. So we'll start with our commission staff person, Patrick Fawn here, but just go around and introduce yourselves.
I'm Patrick Fawn. I'm the director of the Public Utilities Division here at the commission.
John Chu, PSC staff.
Adam Williams, Director of Communications for Meridian.
I'm sorry, what was your first name?
Adam.
Frank Gasecco, Executive Vice President, General Counsel.
Hold it here. You're going too fast for me to write down. Frank what? Could you spell it, please?
G-O-S-E-C-O.
Okay.
Bill Prentice, CEO of Meridian.
Lawrence Bender. I'm a lawyer in Bismarck, and I represent Meridian.
Dan Hedrington, and I'm with SEH. We're an engineering firm. I'm part of the design team.
Greg Kessel. I'm a landowner, lifetime Billings County resident, and part of the Meridian.
Okay. So this is kind of a little bit of an unusual situation for us, and most of the time if we were having a, when I said use the term meeting as an official term, we would have a case before us, and we don't. So this isn't one of our meetings per se. Typically, everything that we do with a quorum around here is open to the public, and we try to kind of bend over backwards to make sure that the public and the press are aware of these things. Typically, we would only broadcast a real case that we have, making an exception because, I mean, this has been in the news. There's been things written about it in the press, and so we are broadcasting this, even though it's not a case. But that is one exception. I also want to say that this is a situation where because it's been in the public eye, the company has come in to visit with us. And so this is not going to be a situation for anyone else to be asking questions. This is a discussion between the company and us. And I think that needs to be respected. I appreciate the fact that the company is coming in to address what seems to be different perceptions about what is being constructed and whether it falls into siting thresholds that we go by the law. There are some interesting things that I think it's important for the public to understand. First of all, I've heard and read things about, you know, you guys need to make them come in and apply for a siting permit. I don't really see anywhere in the law where we can compel someone to come in and apply for a siting permit. If someone is building something that requires siting, and this hasn't happened, so I'm kind of just making assumptions about what would happen if someone is building something that, let's say it wasn't a disputed situation, but that definitely required siting, as soon as they would turn over ground, someone would, I assume, realize that and file a complaint here, and we'd end up in a case, and everything would get delayed for them. Until they would start that, nothing has happened. They haven't applied, so we don't have a case to deal with to compel someone to come in and apply. That's just the law. That's not our decision. It just is what the law is. And then it's also important to remember, and I don't know the timing of when these thresholds were set, but there are very specific guidelines in the law as to when gas or liquid energy conversion facilities, and that's what this would be, when they need to have a siting permit from the PSC in order to build. And there are three. One is for refining of gas, and that's 100 million cubic feet per day. And I'm getting to a point on this. The other is for refinement of liquid hydrocarbons, and that is 50,000 barrels per day. What I found most interesting in planning for today is this last one, and that is enrichment of uranium minerals, and there is no number. So if you were enriching uranium minerals, it wouldn't matter the size. The legislature has said that you need a siting certificate. But with the gas and with the liquids, they have set thresholds. In the case of liquids, in this case, it's 50,000 barrels. So it's clear that the legislature has contemplated this and in one instance said any of this activity would require a permit. In the other two has said, well, above a certain threshold. So I didn't remember that about the uranium, but it's clear that these thresholds have been set and set for a purpose by the legislature. So now the discussion in my mind will revolve around just what is being built here over the course of planning, and I don't remember the first time I ever heard of this, but probably at least a couple of years. It seems I've heard different numbers thrown about, and so I think it'll be interesting to have a discussion with the company and find out just what is in the planning stages as of right now. Commissioner Crosius, did you have any opening comments?
Just want to say thank you for coming in to hopefully answer some of the questions that I have. Obviously, there are two issues at hand here. One is of public interest, and that related to public interest, and that would be proximity to the park. And that's not a siting criteria for the commission itself. It can come into play, but the second would be the threshold for whether or not you do or do not have to come in and get a siting permit for the facility. There has been just a considerable amount of press on this, and even on I think the question that keeps coming up for me and one that the primary question is just in terms of some of the information that even through your own press releases from a year ago was at 55,000 barrels. I think I read one quote at 60,000 barrels, and now it's at 49,500 barrels, just under the threshold, which would mean it's not jurisdictional to the Public Service Commission. But that will be one of the big underlying questions that I have as we visit and have a conversation about this. And then I'll also have some questions as well in terms of location and proximity to the park and just why that particular location was selected. Mm. And I'm quite certain we'll get I'll get some answers on both of those. So that would include my remarks at this point.
And even though we don't have a case, if we did have a case having to do with liquid hydrocarbon product refinement, it would fall under Commissioner Fedorchek's portfolio. So we're going to kind of just pretend like it is, and that's why she's going to go last and now evolve it into the company statements. There was one other point that I wanted to make for people who aren't familiar with Public Service Commission activities, either in the room or watching the broadcast. If, in fact, we were in a siting hearing or many other types of hearings that we have here, we often involve a administrative law judge, and the witnesses would be under oath. We don't have a case, so the company people are not under oath here today. However, these things are recorded, And if we ultimately end up in a case, I could envision people challenging any decisions that we make, or being involved as interveners. And if something is being done here that is ignoring the obvious intent of the legislature, I could easily see this recording being brought in as evidence in a case where people are under oath. So I think it is important for us to have this discussion, and that not necessarily just looking for some technicalities, but hopefully following the obvious intent of what the legislature had in mind here. Commissioner Fedorchak, go ahead and take it away.
Thank you, Randy. Thank you, Brian. And thank you all for coming and agreeing to meet with us. We really appreciate you being willing to do that. So we've had give and take through Lawrence mostly since 2016 on this project. I remember the first day I read it in the newspaper that this project was being considered, and the first thought that came to mind before I looked at the location was, wow, more refining. Because, quite honestly, we can't lose sight of the fact that that has been a goal for North Dakota for many years. And politicians from both sides of the aisle have been questioning, why can't we have more refining in our state? We have this great product. We use it here. We need more refining. There was even proposals for a state-run refinery at one point. And so the fact that this project does that and provides 200 to 250 jobs, it's a big deal for North Dakota, and I don't want to lose sight of that either in the conversation. So we took note of it immediately and noticed the threshold that you were proposing was 55,000, and that's within our threshold. So in the early reports, we triggered conversations with you right away saying, FYI, that's jurisdictional to us, so please plan to have a siting process as part of your plans develop. And then, you know, then there was a give and take for the last couple of years back and forth between our office and our staff and yours, talking about, you know, the fact that you were going to come in under at first, et cetera, et cetera. So it seemed time for us to sit down and just talk, because we've been going back and forth for 2 years now, and this is it's a big project in our state. It's a big deal, and we want to make sure that it's done right and with the as much as possible the support of the citizens that live in North Dakota and operate and live in that area. So appreciate the fact that you've already done a long hearing locally and you've gotten your conditional use permit. And I would assume that there was a lot of discussion there about the location. And so I want to hear more about, through our conversation this morning, what your plans are to address some of the concerns. And then I also want to just point out, Randy talked some about the law and the requirements of it. And I think, and I try to keep this in mind on all of our siting cases, what are we doing this for? Why do we do this? Have a siting hearing and make companies go through this process. And it's really well stated in the law, in the statement of policy on the front end of the siting law. And I just wanted to read two lines from that. And this goes back, I think Patrick Fawn has been on staff as long as we've done siting. He probably helped create some of the law and the rules governing it. So we have a lot of knowledge and experience in this area sitting right here at the table. And that can be very valuable to you all as well. So the statement of policy reads, and this is 49-2202, the Legislative Assembly finds that the construction of energy conversion facilities and transmission facilities affects the environment and the welfare of the citizens of this state. Therefore, it's necessary to ensure that the location, construction, and operation of energy conversion facilities and transmission facilities will produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and upon the welfare of the citizens of this state by providing that no energy conversion facility or transmission facility shall be located, constructed and operated within this state without a certificate of site compatibility or route permit acquired pursuant to this chapter. And then it defines the thresholds. So, but clearly, the recognition is these facilities impact the citizens, and so we want to have a thoughtful process for where they're located and how they're constructed and operated. And so I ask you all to just keep that in mind, too, as we talk this morning about what we're all trying to accomplish here and how we can best get to that goal. So I have a series of questions, and I'd be happy to start in there, but I thought it might be best if you had some opening comments or if you wanted to provide some general information first. And so I'd invite you to do that, and then we can take the conversation from there.
Sure.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. If I were to have made an opening statement, a lot of the things that you all addressed would have been some of the things that I would have said as well. Let me just add a little bit to what you've all indicated this morning. This has been a dialogue that's been going back and forth between the commission and Meridian for about 2 years. It started with telephone calls from Mr. Fahn to me. I responded to phone calls. We ultimately prepared a letter and sent it to the commission, which was dated July 20th, 2016. Later on, there was other things in the newspapers, probably misinformation that resulted in another communication from Mr. Fahn to me. I responded to that. But I agree with you, Commissioner Fedorchak. We can probably accomplish a lot more by having a dialogue here today than we can by sending letters back and forth, because you prepare a letter and send it to Meridian, I respond, that raises more questions, and it just takes more time. So we welcome the opportunity to sit down with you today, talk about this, and Mr. Prentice is going to make a brief opening remark, talk a little bit about the project, where it is here today, and we have many members of the Meridian staff who are here to respond to questions, but primarily Mr. Prentice will be making the presentation. So,
great. Thank you, Lawrence.
And for all of you that aren't as familiar with our work in this hearing room as Mr. Bender, even though we're only a few feet apart, it's important to talk into the microphones because that's how the recording is picked up, so as well as for the broadcast. So. Please do take the time to talk into the microphones.
I do also want to just reinforce what you were saying early on, Randy. This isn't an opportunity for public comment or public commentary of any sort, so I really am going to impress on the importance of the audience to not make any comments of any sort, size, whatever, to whatever information. I mean, this is really a dialogue between us, and there will be opportunity for the public through the health department processes to, at the very least, express their opinion through those processes and others, but this is not the time or the place for that.
And if we end up with a citing case, there would be opportunity for
absolutely.
Public comments as well.
Which would be great.
Well, thank you, Mr. President, members of the commission. Our mission here is to dispel a lot of the confusion about the project that's emerged. Most of that confusion is our fault. We're a small company producing a big project, and the amount of interest that this project has generated has been something we did not expect. We're not necessarily prepared to handle the publicity involved. Now that we have Adam on board, handling communications, we can tighten up our message and avoid some of these confusing press statements and so forth. What I'd like to do is just describe briefly how the project came about and the current status of it, and then we can delve into your questions and be at your disposal. The company was started about 5 years ago by a group of North Dakota expatriates under the name of the Davis Family Partnership. They were formed to reestablish some of the agricultural roots of the families represented here in North Dakota. And those are primarily members of the Davis and Palotnick families. While they were here taking care of that business, they saw the oil boom going on and kind of fell in love with the idea of creating something that would help avoid what had resulted in all of those North Dakota people being out of state. North Dakota goes through this every year. Sons and daughters have to go out of state after they finish school, find opportunity. The initial impetus here was to create jobs. And as you pointed out, we've done a good job so far of that. We could have engineered a project that had fewer employees, but we've not tried to do that. We're going to employ about 200 people at the facility. Using figures from the state of Washington developed in studies of the Anacortes refineries, the job multiplier is about 12 to 1. So total employment, including direct, indirect, and induced jobs, can be as high as 2,400 in that area. The other thing we've done, it's been our policy never to go after any sort of tax benefits or breaks. We're going to pay our taxes. The tax base of Billings County is going to grow a lot after we're in business. That's going to help with the prosperity in the region and the opportunities for people. Now, when I was approached about becoming the CEO of the company, I had no real reason to do this. I built power plants, refineries all over the world. And quite frankly, I'm not real proud of some of those facilities. Here was an opportunity for me to reinvent something in this business, and that's why I took this job. I was given a clear path to build the kind of refinery that I would like to see every day if I were in the area. My mandate was to build the right refinery for this location, and I informed everybody that would not be cheap. This is going to be the cleanest refinery in the world when it's done. It's not going to be cheap. So that's what we decided to do. When the location became an issue with regard to proximity to the park, that was primarily during the period when we were getting our use permit. The idea that being closer to the park would require that we be held to higher standards was interesting to us because it was an opportunity to make it even cleaner, which we did. We instituted design changes beginning of this year that resulted in an air quality amendment or permit amendment application that resulted in reductions in the emissions that we were requesting as part of our permit. Our idea has not been to move the refinery someplace where we could pollute more. It's been to build the cleanest refinery in this industry and change the industry as a result. So, in fact, the location of the plant, from our perspective, is an opportunity to show what the industry can achieve. And I think that everybody's going to be pleased with the result. In terms of capacity, in the press, we've been all over the map, and that's probably my fault. Now it's going to be Adam's fault if it happens anymore. But, the original intent of the founder, when they saw what was happening at Dakota Prairie, was to kind of copy them, put a 20,000-barrel-per-day topping plant in. In fact, they had initial discussions with Ventec, and that was one of the first things I did is kill that. Instead, the intent was to build a 27,500-barrel-per-day hydroskimming plant, which produces diesel, gasoline blending stock, and residual oil that's very low in sulfur. So with the new rules going into effect in 2020, that's a valuable material. We did not really plan to go beyond that until we got into the air quality process. And the air quality groups were division at Department of Health wanted us to provide a permit application that addressed any possible expansion in the future. But I want to make a distinction here between possibilities and plans. Our plan has always been 27.5. In addressing the air quality requirements, it was an opportunity for us to explore whether or not we can meet these very stringent air quality requirements with a larger plant. That's been our process for the past year. But the fact is, when we get this air quality permit, which I hope will be finalized sometime early next year, we are going to start construction of a 27,500-barrel-per-day refinery, and that's what we're going to operate. If we ever expand beyond that and get up to that threshold, you will see a siting application from us. We went through a siting process with the County of Billings, and I thought they did a very thorough and proper job. You know, there's always been, in the energy industry, a distinction between developing projects in the various states. I've developed power plants and run them and operated them, for instance, in California, and it's always been the toughest in the country to get something done there. I thought the air quality process here in North Dakota is every bit as tough as California, and the people in that division are just as knowledgeable. I don't think that we would have had a more difficult time in the conditional use permit process in any other county in the country. We had to work very hard to satisfy the county as to what we were doing there, and Dan's company is the one that was handling that for us. So, you know, we're on the record. Our intent is clear. We want to get our permit from the Air Quality Division, from the Department of Health, so that we can start construction of our refinery at 27.5. That's going to be up and operating for years before we decide what to do next. There are many modifications that we could do to the plant to increase profitability that would not involve an increase in capacity. You know, part of getting used to this market appears to learn some of the nuances. You know, the residual oil that comes out of this refinery is good feedstock for lubricating oils. So we're going to explore that. But until we get 27.5 in operation, we don't have a basis for making any further plans.
So can you tell us what you have incorporated into this project to make it a facility that, in your words, is something that you'd want to drive by and look at and see? Like, what is special about this that makes it unlike every refinery I've ever been by, which is something I want to get by as quickly as possible, because they aren't very pretty to look at.
I know. And, you know, consider the source. People who build and operate refineries are inordinately proud of them. I mean, you see them at night. They look like the most densely lighted Christmas tree you'd ever seen in your life. We've had to get used to a different way of looking at that. First of all, we're putting this facility in the middle of a very large piece of property so that we can put a buffer around it, including, you know, natural buffer, including trees and so forth. We're working with both local universities to make that happen. We've already ensured that you cannot see or smell or hear the refinery from the park.
How have you ensured that, Bill?
Well, the big thing was visual impact and the idea that you might be able to see our highest tower from the park. This occurred about a week or so before we had the final hearing on our use permit. And Dan's company had surveyors go out to the site. And first we tried a balloon, but it was too windy. So we had to anchor a kite that was bigger than our biggest vessel. It was about 13 feet wide. And our biggest vessel is going to be 130 feet tall and 10 feet wide. So we anchored that kite at the height of the top of that tower in exactly the same location. And we had a bunch of people up on Buck Hill at the park looking for it, and you can't see it. It had already been demonstrated through line-of-sight studies, you know, on an engineering basis, that it was below the horizon from the park. But, you know, you have to see it to believe it. So we did that.
And is that at night, too? The lights, I would assume, would be visible at night.
Well, you probably will be able to see a glow from the red FAA-required lights. But the lighting concept on this refinery has been, well, we've trashed everything from the industry standard practices. If operators can turn off the lights in the bathroom when they're done, they can turn off the light on the crude tower. If there's nothing going on there, There's no reason for that Christmas tree effect to be going on. So what lights have to be on all the time for OSHA requirements will be downward directed, you know, lights that we hope nobody's going to see. You'll be able to see the light in the refinery probably driving by on I-94. The other thing that came up was concerns about cooling tower drift. People who've seen local refineries, I mean, cooling towers are a part of almost every process out there. So we went to air cooling. There's only one cooling tower about the same size as the one on the roof of this building. And, you know, it's been our estimate that you're going to be able to see that maybe, 20 days a year, something like that.
I think it's for clarification of things, like there's a potential to see it. I'd like to make a distinction on that for the plume itself, for the cooling tower, which is just water vapor. There's a potential to see that plume. It's potential 24 feet above the horizon, 7.5 miles away, and so I mean virtually invisible, and that only occurs like 30 times a year. And in reality, it's only going to occur maybe in a morning on a very cold day when that actually, in low wind conditions, where it actually is going to rise to that level.
Have you had any of the park folks, the park leadership, out to see your kite demonstration and
yes,
all of this material? And what's been their response?
I should let Dan answer that. He conducted the test and was at Buck Hill when it was undertaken.
Right, and we'll, just for the commission's information as well, we did full modeling of that as well. We did line-of-sight diagrams and exhibits, and we showed all that to county commissioners and stuff as well. And then there was some discussion, well, you're positively going to see it anyway, so that's why we went and did the kite demonstration from the location that it was that the park officials thought we might be able to see it. The park was invited. I don't know that the leaders came, but park officials were definitely there, so some of the rangers and things like that were up at the site reviewing it, along with county personnel. A lot of county people actually came up to review it as well, because we had expressed, you know, what our expectations were at county board meetings, and so they came up to confirm it, and it all went very well.
That was the 11-foot kite, I believe, 150 feet above the ground.
That's correct. Yeah.
How many miles are you from the nearest border of the park, and then also from the interstate? Because I've seen a little bit of information out in the press, but not a lot of specifics and not a lot of clarity.
Okay. We handed out this map as part of that two-pager that Lawrence gave you. The refinery site is 3.5 miles from the nearest corner of the park. And I think we're less than a mile from the interstate. On that map, that little yellow site on the Burlington is the site that we're locating the refinery at.
And what will the view shed be from the interstate? Will you be screening that with trees? And what's the long-term prognosis for that?
We're going to try to disguise the project with trees and agricultural buffer from both the interstate and from the city of Belfield itself. Our objective is to not be able to see it at all.
You said the nearest corner of the yellow refinery site to the nearest corner of the park is 3 miles?
3.5.
3.5. How far is it from where the railroad is the farthest to the north? From there to the interstate?
Right where that arrow points to the yellow, I think that's about a mile, maybe a little less, to the property line. It's going to be a little over a mile to the actual, what we call the battery limits of the refinery, where the processing unit is.
What's the kind of white rectangle within the area of the refinery?
That's another piece of property that we've since optioned.
But so does the yellow, is that the, you said something about like a tree buffer and such.
Yeah.
Would the tree buffer be within this yellow area, or is the yellow area the refinery site itself, and then the tree buffer would be around that?
The buffer we're talking about would be on the northern edge of the property along the tracks, at the other side of the railroad tracks from the refinery, and all the way down the eastern boundary.
Okay. Did you tell me about other sites that you considered?
Before I came on board the company, the founder of the company, Tom Williams, had consulted with a number of people, including some people from Burlington, and considered sites as far away as South Hart, where there was previous consideration of a coal gasification facility. Tom Williams settled on this particular site because of the confluence of 85, I-94, the railroad, and crude gathering systems in that area because of the Freiburg facility. In all respects, except for the proximity of the park, it's an ideal site.
Mm-hmm. So you can still get the a lot of those factors if you were on the other side of Belfield, except perhaps the pipelines? Is that the big driver to this site?
To get the same advantages, you'd probably have to go as far as Dickinson or beyond.
Mm-hmm. And are there advantages to being there just because you're closer to markets? And just it seems like there'd be some natural advantages. You're closer to more workers, a stronger workforce. There's got to be other advantages that a Dickinson site might offer that don't exist out there so close to the park.
When I was presented with this opportunity and took a look at the proximity of the park, again, that did not seem a detriment given the fact that we could engineer to meet those requirements. Everything else was overwhelmingly positive.
So if you were contemplating something this close to, say, Yellowstone or Grand Canyons, would that be a bigger issue, you think, or you'd still feel just as confident that this the air quality, the light mitigation, all these factors can be addressed to make it basically undetectable from those locations?
We have no current intent to go elsewhere like that, but the same considerations would enter into it if there were other reasons to be there. See, the industry has gotten used to just saying, okay, we're bad polluters. Put us someplace where we can do what we do and not bother anybody. And I am not going to do that. This refinery is going to be one that you should be able to put anywhere.
Well, and I really appreciate your commitment to their quality issues and to setting a higher standard for the refining industry as a whole. I think we could have a long conversation about industrial development and having certain corridors for it and where those ought to be. I mean, I think that there's a lot to be said for trying to cluster those in locations where there's similar type development occurring. I'm not sure this site meets that standard, although there is that rail facility there. I haven't seen that rail facility, so I don't know how visible that is.
It's probably more visible from the freeway anyway than our plant will be. Mm-hmm. And we did have this discussion at length with the county and, you know, went through all the reasons for this location. And I think we resolved that issue to their satisfaction anyway.
Mm-hmm. Was there a lot of input on at the local level from citizens?
Yes. We had a very well-attended meeting of the Rezoning and Planning Commission in Billings County, and then, three separate hearings before the full commission at Billings County.
What is the county line there? Is that a gravel county road, or is it is there nothing there except a section line? Or
nothing
there. For the recording, it was indicated from someone off mic that there is nothing there.
No, the county line has no physical presence other than just on the map.
Okay.
Will that need to be upgraded for this? It doesn't have to do with our issues here, but I'm just curious.
As part of the permit application, and discussions, we agreed to do a number of things with local roads, and including improving any of the roads that we'll be using for our traffic. So,
do you have any? I'm sorry.
If we ultimately, if this were built and then expanded and had a siting case, in any of our siting cases, regardless of how clean or new and innovatively someone is doing something, there are, in the law, avoidance and exclusion areas. The avoidance areas are places where we may or may not be able to issue a certificate, depending on other circumstances. Exclusion areas are just that. We can't approve those. Are there avoidance or exclusion issues within those distances that would preclude a certificate if you were applying for one?
I'm not aware of any. The park itself would, of course, be an exclusion zone. But, we have not reviewed that.
There aren't residences at Freiburg or in the surrounding area that are too close or anything like that?
I might talk about that a little bit. I'm the only resident that's near there, and I don't plan on moving.
You had meant, it looked like you wanted to say something earlier, too, Greg. So.
Well, a couple of things on the county thing. I've been a Billings County resident my whole life, and I know what we need. We need this in our county for tax revenue. We're in a county with 50% federal ground, park service, forest service, and what have you. These are the people that want services, that come to visit, and want all the emergency services, and they want everything there, and our taxes keep going up. And in Billings County, we do not have the population. We have the city of Medora. We don't have nothing to regenerate them revenues coming back. And this is something that's going to be a shot in the arm for the Billings County. I'm hoping, I have four children at home. They're high-paying jobs. I'm hoping that we can bring these jobs to the kids. And that's what we need for our young people. We need to keep them back at home. We don't need them traveling off. Same reason the Davis family went ahead and came back. They left the country. This is an opportunity for us to keep our young people back.
Mm-hmm. So what's your thoughts on how the locals feel about it after the conditional use permit and that process, Greg? Did a lot of the issues get satisfied?
As a whole, the majority of the locals are all for this. They just got their taxes again. They've seen what their taxes did. They know what this can do for them. Right now, they're struggling with adding on to their school. They don't know where the revenues are coming from. They need to do that. We need this in our county. We need that revenue. Mm-hmm. And we need to create the jobs for the people that are leaving. And, yes, the park is important to us in our county. I mean, I lived there my whole life. That's always been important to me. And that is a lot of the reason, the air quality thing. And this is the kind of project that is good. It's good for the community. It's good for the surrounding area. It's not, I've been in agriculture my whole life, but the drivers of the state are energy and ag, and these are the kind of projects that we need in our state.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that at first folks were more suspicious of the project or maybe a little more leery, and then as the discussions occurred on the local level and they learned more, they may have become more comfortable with it. Would that be a fair?
That's a fair assessment. I mean, when this project started, the reluctance that someone can come in and build something with Class 1 air quality standards, it sounded like a pipe dream, like it couldn't happen. Take a look at, we haven't built a refinery in 45 years. How did your cell phone work 45 years ago? We've came so far with technology, you've got to take a look at things like this.
And I've been in conversation with the health department, Dave Glott, and I know there's some health department folks here today, this morning. So I know that your permit that you have is a construction permit, and that just allows you to construct it. Then you still have to prove that you can actually operate it and meet the criteria for that facility, which I think is maybe 10 times more stringent than a facility such as Tesoro right outside just because of its proximity
yes.
to the park. So talk a little bit about that. I mean, how confident are you in this technology? Because from what I understand from my conversation with Dave, it's not new technology, but it's applied in a way that hasn't been done before.
Well, in order to justify getting a permit using this technology, you have to show that every single aspect of it has been used commercially someplace else. So none of it's R&D. What's unique here is this is the first project in the country, in the world, where every piece of applicable technology is going to be applied comprehensively throughout the project. And that includes everything from optical sensing for leaks. And I don't know if anybody who's not been in a refinery understands how important that is, because usually refineries I've been in, you wait till there's a combustible puddle of something before you figure out that you have a leak and a problem. And sometimes that happens when you get a fire. It's a matter of bad engineering, bad management, bad safety. We don't want that. So we have optical sensing. Whenever anything starts to leak, you're going to know it, and you go fix it. You know, it would take a couple of hours. I mean, if you access the database on the Air Quality Division's website, there are thousands of pages of documentation as to what we've done to make this clean. And none of it's R&D. So I'm comfortable we can do this.
So you put it all together, but have you proven this in another location that this actually works the way you're proposing it at this site?
Every single aspect that we are proposing to build has been proven, yes.
Okay. The engineer is agreeing.
Yeah, the team has actually been thrilled to work on the project. Mr. Prentice and his leadership team have given us direction, not only just the ability to incorporate, you know, innovative things, but cost is never been the critical element on it. It's been try to improve visibility, try to improve, you know, reduction in emissions, try to, you know, make this as I'm going to use the term green as possible. And we've been working with the University of, you know, UND and NDSU for some of the screening things you had asked about earlier, looking at berms and vegetation, and everything that is being incorporated into this has been, you know, completely at the direction of Mr. Prentice and his leadership team. It's been absolutely a wonderful project to work on.
Mm-hmm. And if you build it and can't meet the standards, it doesn't operate, from what I understand of the permit, or you'd have to apply for some sort of a variance.
We have to fix it. If it didn't operate the way it's designed, yes. Mm-hmm. We have had to go through that not only for the purpose of the permit, but also in negotiating arrangements for design and construction of the plant, because there have to be ironclad guarantees from our contractors that they can do this too. That's all backed up by financial instruments, and the funding is not there if you don't prove this can happen.
You still have some water permits, wastewater and source water. Tell me the status of those permits and the timeline there.
Well, just briefly, and then Dan's the best one to talk about the water authorization or allocation permit. But the idea here is building a plant in an area where water is as precious. It's a zero discharge facility. The water is going to get used and reused and so forth. We even collect rainwater for use as part of that resource base. We've talked about using wastewater from local communities as part of our water source. In making decisions on where to have our mainstay water supply, if you will, the decision was made to apply for a permit to take water out of the Dakota Aquifer, which is very highly saline. It's in some areas that we've seen test reports, it's worse than seawater. So we're also effectively building a desalination plant at the refinery to handle that water. So, you know, that application went out for a requested quantity that was based on the fact that we don't understand that aquifer very well yet. So we were scaled back on the amounts that we're going to be able to utilize out of Dakota, and we're just going to have to engineer around that. The status of that permit, I think we're the yeah. Go ahead, Dan.
The status is we had gone through the and I'm sure you guys are completely familiar with this, all the public hearing process, comment period. The department acknowledged their intent to issue, and it's being contested. An adjudicative hearing is being requested. The state engineer is going to allow that. An administrative law judge is reviewing it, and we're still in that process. We're expecting activity again in January to start coming up again.
Can you clarify for me, are you at 645 acre feet of water per year, or 90% of that number?
So I apologize for not having the specific number on the top of my head. What we applied for the overall volume that we thought was necessary based on our assumptions of that aquifer itself. We won't know complete details until we actually drill the hole, draw it up, and find out how brackish it is or how saline it is. So we have some flexibility there. We're going to have to, like Mr. Prentice said, we're going to have to design the cleaning system around what we encounter. But I believe that the what was requested, it was a 10% reduction that was being offered. So it was, I believe it was 400 gallons a minute knocked down, essentially knocked down to 360, something like that.
And then the wastewater permit?
Yeah, those are...
Are those tied together?
They're not tied. That's still in process. We'll be going through that entire process yet. Some of it boils down to we're not sure how much water we're going to have to get rid of. So what happens essentially is that you clean up that water, and part of your waste is just a more concentrated brine. There are multiple ways to get rid of that. We can do, you know, evaporation ponds, things like that. But there's also potential for injection or utilizing existing injection wells out there. And all of those are still being discussed and reviewed. And once we actually drill the hole, see that water, we'll understand how much we're going to have, all that kind of stuff. So still pending.
What's the depth of that aquifer?
Approximately 5,000 feet. So it's deep. And actually, some of the drill companies that we had talked to initially were a little bit concerned about going that deep just because they didn't have the capability, but we found plenty that can. So, it's an exciting project. We're doing a lot of innovative things on this project in order to be less impactful to the locals. We've been directed from day one to not utilize any of the existing potable aquifers. So there's a lot of really good things going on in this project.
What do you estimate for a time frame then? It sounds like you've still got a fair amount of work to do on the water side of things. Is that a year out before you'd even be able to finish that permitting process and then move forward after that if everything goes well on the air quality side? Or what are you thinking in terms of timeline for construction?
Well, with weather like this, I mean, we could be in construction this winter if we had our air quality permit. So
you can construct without the water stuff done?
Yeah. Remember, we have multiple options as far as for water. So we can go in and start earthwork. We can start some of the roadway improvements. We can do stormwater collection areas, things like that, that can be started, you know, in advance.
Weather might look a whole lot different by this time tomorrow.
Yeah, I know. I know. But it looks good today.
Says the lifelong rancher.
But you mentioned overall timeline. We start construction as soon as we obtain the permit. We could be in operation by, let's say, first quarter of 2019 at this schedule.
Now, and that assumes you complete the water permits, or how do the water permits factor into that timeline?
Well, we need that water for operation. If, let's say, we were not able to use Dakota Aquifer at all for whatever reason, whether it's permits or technical, we'll engineer around it and find other sources.
And are you looking at an injection well for waste at all, wastewater?
If what we end up with is a situation where we're taking aquifer water in, desalinating it, then you end up with a brine-rich water stream that we understand is okay to re-inject in that aquifer. It's the aquifer that's used for re-injection wells right now. So that's what we've been instructed would be the proper course. I'm not sure that's what we're going to do,
though.
Then
would you be reusing that water, too? You'd be injecting it in there and potentially reusing that same water in that same area?
One of the things that I'd like to figure out, first of all, is what is in that water. You're drilling down to a level that would be considered a good oil well depth in some areas. You're mining water. Well, there's minerals in it. What are they? We've had discussions with some of the oil service firms about taking a look at some of those chemicals. So I'm not sure yet. There might be more jobs involved in processing that wastewater.
You mentioned a few minutes ago in conversation in response to one of Randy's questions about you hadn't really looked at the exclusion areas and avoidance areas on this site. And so that is an area that gives me a little concern because that's precisely why when a facility is looking to grow beyond and into the jurisdictional area where we have siting authority and it is pre-existing and you haven't looked at what those factors are that we consider, then you've probably already impacted them. So, that's why, and I want to just throw this out, companies like Basin Electric, who have operated in North Dakota for a long, long time, when they think that they're going to be jurisdictional at some point, they site on the front end. And then they're free to go. They know they've looked at everything. There's been the public opportunity to comment and learn. And everything is done from the front end to mitigate impacts to the things that state leaders have laid out need to be protected. So have you thought about taking that approach? And if not, why not?
Well, in terms of the exclusionary areas, when I say we haven't looked at it, we haven't formally looked at it. We went through this process for the county, and, we reviewed that list of exclusionary areas and zones and didn't think anything was applicable. But again, at that time, our feeling was we were in a siting proceeding at the county. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we dealt with those issues.
I guess I would just urge you to be using caution because their siting proceeding might not go by the law that we mm-hmm. are required to follow in our siting proceeding. And Greg had mentioned being the one that lives close by. If, let's say, as you are proposing it today, you built and then later decided to do an expansion that crossed the jurisdictional threshold and you got above that, and I don't know how closest is, but as I recall, looking at our attorney, I don't believe you can give a waiver if you're closer than 500 feet from a residence.
No, we went through that process at the county level.
There's some things that maybe a county was able to waive in approving something. We can't necessarily waive things whether we want to or not. So I guess I'm curious if that residence is within 500 feet or not. But
well, the whole issue of residences and where we could put the processing units themselves in comparison to all that. I mean, that was a 3-month dialogue on that with the county.
Right, and remember, we did go through and do archaeologics and cultural and endangered species studies and stuff as well on the property. So the amount of research has been extensive, I'm very confident that we're in a good position. So
I'll just throw this out. We've had pipeline cases where someone wanted to either expand the volume of a pipeline or change from a gathering pipeline to a transmission pipeline, and thus they became jurisdictional. And so they were laid in there, and there was a neighbor across the road that was too close, and whether it was because they knew they had bargaining power or were more worried about what was going to be there than what had always been there, would not deal with them, and they ended up having to completely reroute the pipeline. And so it's good to look ahead at these things for everyone's best interests.
We're well aware of the negotiating position of nearby landowners.
Did the county require any bonding or any sort of financial assurances should you have to get to the point where you've constructed it, can't meet the standards, and need to reclaim that area?
Yeah, there is a bonding requirement before we start actual earthwork. Yes.
Okay. And then I've had a lot of letters from some folks in the area that are concerned about the truck traffic and those issues. So talk a little bit about that and what you view immediately and at what point you think those numbers might be reduced by the use of pipelines and the rail system for transport.
Well, you know, truck is the least economical and probably least safe way to move hydrocarbons. We do have local markets that cannot be reached any other way. So we're stuck with that. But in terms of crude delivery, it'll all be by pipeline. Eventually, probably well over half of our products will be going out by pipeline. And we're going to drive truck as far down as we can. We're also on rail, and not only are we close to another rail facility, but we're going to have our own rail sidings, and we'll be shipping out not unit trains, but multi-car shipments of rail. So, yeah, truck is not preferable except for local uses.
So when you talk about half your, or for local uses, do you mean finished product or your product in? Will all the crude that you're getting be delivered on site by pipeline?
Yes, ma'am.
So all your source will be piped?
Yes.
So some of your finished product will be trucked, but you anticipate, did you say half? Out, half of it will be out by, is it rail, or do you have pipelines to distribute the finished product to?
It depends. We're right now trying to finalize some of these offtake discussions. Anything that goes to the east or to the south or to the west, probably by rail.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that would go up and down 85 and out on 94 would be by truck. Again, we're trying to get that number as low as we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're not near any line that that pipeline that transports refined gasoline.
Yeah. Once we get into operation, we're going to try to see about where our firmer demand is setting up and whether or not a pipeline solution is best for that, mm-hmm. Particularly to the east.
So tell us a little bit about your market. Where is it? When the Dickinson refinery is being developed, they anticipated that initially to have a really strong local market for the diesel, and then plans changed quite a bit.
Yes.
So what are you anticipating?
Diesel and gasoline still have a strong demand locally. The residual oil is probably going to go out to the east, to the Great Lakes. It's a low-sulfur marine fuel. Again, some of it might go up to Canada. Some of the other things we're looking at is who are we going to be doing business with locally who want to do their own blending, for gasohol and also biodiesel. So again, these are negotiations in progress now.
So generally speaking, in thirds, a third diesel, a third gasoline, a third low sulfur?
Yes. Yeah.
So now I'm confused on that. As I recall from dealing with what was then the Tesoro refinery here by town, it's not a three-way division. There's probably a dozen products, the tar for asphalt and paraffin wax and all
sure.
kinds of things. The Dickinson plant, my understanding, has always been it's probably not quite the same. Basically take the diesel fuel off and send the rest out as still unrefined.
Right.
Is your proposal to do a full refining job like is done here at Mandan and produce this whole array of products that can be made out of a barrel of oil, or to just do gas and diesel and then send everything else out in one bulk product?
Well, again, three different refineries, totally different processes, totally different time frames. The Dickinson, Dakota Prairie, as you say, was a topping unit. They were going to pull diesel off, sell to the local drilling community, and then the rest of what they produce would go to other refineries. Mandan has been there a while. They don't typically use all Bakken crude. They use other types of crude, too. So they have to be more complicated in order to get their product streams out. And they've grown over time to meet other market requirements. So that's been an organic response to the market that they've faced. What we've done is design what is probably the smallest possible full conversion refinery that you can build. And, you know, part of that process is getting the low sulfur marine diesel out. And, you know, part of that later on might become other higher value products. We haven't talked about other things like, you know, liquefied natural gas. We get small amounts of those materials. So, yeah, one third is the gross division, but there are another three or four products in there that we just haven't defined yet.
And we talk quite a bit just on the environmental side of things about visual and some on the water, but there's also noise too. And you said this would be quieter. Why is it quieter? And is it just because you're a ways away from any residences, or
well, there's that, the buffer, you know, just the control instrumentation. Some of the old pneumatic controls were like the air brakes on a truck, you know. You can hear valves going off all over a plant like that. We're not doing that. But, you know, it's just some areas will be enclosed that would otherwise be open and noisy. I mean, that makes sense when you're in a cold climate, that guys working on stuff can stay warmer while they're doing that. So there are multiple reasons for doing that, but the result is a quieter plant.
Did you look at locating, or would it be feasible? And Greg, not no offense, because I know your land is where your land is, but did you look at even further south in Billings County to get you further away from the park? And I mean, you're going through a lot of expensive measures to meet the standards required by being so close to the park. So I have to wonder if it wouldn't be just as economical to build further south and get a rail spur, or, you know, look at some other options for tying into the railroad, which seems to be one of the driving forces for keeping you where you're at.
We could have possibly, but once you decide to build a refinery like this and make it the cleanest one, we would have ended up with the same plant further away and paid a higher price in logistics. You're that much further away from I-94. You're further away from the gathering systems. See, the gathering systems are all designed to end up at the railroad. Mm. That's just more pipeline to build. Mm. Farther away from the markets. Part of our gasoline market is up in Canada. So,
what is the...
Mr. Chairman,
could you use the microphone, please?
Oh, sure. We had just a brief discussion about the visual issues on this, and Dan talked a little bit about the kite demonstration and the modeling. Would you mind if he talked a little bit more about that? Because obviously the questions I've gotten have been on visual, and I suspect mm-hmm. you have gotten a lot of questions in that regard as well. Would that be all
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. If you've Absolutely. Got more to add, please
yeah.
do.
Yeah.
Is there anything specific you'd
like
me to address?
You were talking about, you know, the size of the kite, and you were talking about how it was viewed, from where
yes.
it was viewed, who was with you, that sort of thing.
Okay. So, some of the things that might be interesting to you folks, when we made the decision that we were going to do an on-site demonstration, and we invited everybody. We invited the press, and actually,
before you go on with that,
please,
I just want to make an announcement. People are free to kind of come and go. There's a fire capacity sign outside the door. You've probably seen that. If something would happen, you'd kind of follow us. But just if someone needs a break, out in the hallway by the elevators is the ladies' restroom. And for the gentlemen, you walk either one floor up or down, and there's a men's restroom on the odd number floors. So, no, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. So to elaborate just a little bit on it, and I apologize for speaking so loudly into it. When we made the decision to do the on-site demonstration of what that actual line of sight would look like, remember we did exhibits and modeling prior to that. And so when we did it, we had surveyors down below at the actual location of the where the refinery is going to be built. And one of the things that is interesting, when we lifted the kite up to the exact elevation that the top of the highest component was going to be, it couldn't be seen by anybody. People were out there with binoculars, and there was one gentleman had a kind of a little telescope-looking thing, but a lot of spotting scopes, things like that, that they were trying to see it, couldn't see a thing. And it was a clear day, great day for doing this type of demonstration. And then what we decided to do, and actually I think it was one of the members of the press asked, can you lift it higher so we see how high it actually is? We lifted it up an additional 100 feet above what it would be built at. And at that point, only with spotting scopes and binoculars, you could see a pencil speck in the sky. It was just, literally it was a dot. And because, remember, it's 7.5 miles away from the only point that we could see it from. When we lowered it back down, so now okay, anybody that has assistance for seeing scopes or whatever you have, we're going to lower it back down to the actual elevation. Once we lowered it back down, as we started to lower it, it disappeared, and you couldn't see it anymore. So the horizon lines in that area are quite a bit higher than what you're going to see. I think that in regards to what you had said about the lights too, so the lights are on the top of our equipment, so that means the lights are going to be below the horizon line too.
On the top of the tower, though,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly. That's the highest point that we demonstrated, the very highest piece of equipment that we could possibly have or that we're going to have on site. That's what we actually were representing with the kite. So when we dropped it back down, you couldn't see it because of the horizon line.
Is it visible from Painted Canyon, the rest area, the rest stop, the observation area?
No, not at all. In that area, to the point of, we would have to lift it hundreds of feet. That line of sight is, because of the surrounding terrain and the buttes and things in the area, it's much higher. Yeah. So you couldn't see it from Painted Canyon at all.
What did the kite look like? How do you make a kite look like a tower?
So it was just, it was a big kite. It's really what it boiled down.
What was it?
I think it was a red one. And so we wanted it to be as much contrast as we could against the sky. So it was a blue sky. We elevated it. Something to kind of take into account is that when our surveyors were down on the ground, and they were visually scoping it. So what happened is if the wind would shift it and move it a little bit, they would move the ground point so that it would come back into that exact line. So we were 100% positive. We had it in the exact location. We had multiple surveyors out there. We had, just a lot of things going on. With this kind of effort, you want to guard yourself against any scrutiny. And we invited the press, be here, be there, be up on top, wherever you want to be, and the same for any citizen in the area, same for elected officials and park officials. We invited everybody we possibly could. So it was actually, to be honest with you, I was very happy with the turnout. More people showed up than I thought, but like Mr. Kessel had said, initially, there was people were going, is this really true? And what we found and what we were able to prove to them, and they were open enough to want to listen to it, is that we are telling the truth. You cannot see it from that location. It worked out very well. So, and even to be honest with you, what we were, the press, the reports that were out afterwards were very positive as well, indicating that you can't see it. So it worked very well. Is that kind of what you were?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
I might want to make a comment on that. There was an oil rig there all summer long with the derrick in there, which is taller and bigger, and I didn't hear anyone complaining about that they seen that. And that was a quarter mile away. Same elevation, and it was taller, and no one seemed to see that.
Just one question I have is: was the line of sight test, was that done with just a single light?
A single light.
Single light on that kite. For the visual, was there no light on it at
there
all?
No lights.
Okay.
It was during the day.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah. Maybe you could speak a little bit to the cumulative light pollution that the facility may actually cause to the area.
Well, I think that Mr. Prentice addressed it very well. The only lights that are anticipated on the structure and what it's absolutely required by, you know, federal requirements, OSHA, things like that, federal aviation requirements. The other lights that are going to be on site are all going to be downcast and only utilized when necessary. So I think that he explained it very well. The vast majority of the refiners you go by, especially if you go up into Calgary in those areas, everything's lit. And this site is just not designed that way. So we expect that, you know, those impacts are going to be, you know, as little as possible.
Sure. And I don't understand light pollution by any means, but it doesn't cause any radiation or radial effect up there beyond that?
No, I've never encountered anything like that, ever.
And were these studies done with 27.5, I guess with the tower drift, only for the 27.5 barrels? 27,500. Processing capacity facility.
They were done actually for, to be honest with you, we doubled that capacity because of the requirement. You're talking about air permitting now, correct?
Right. I'm talking about the tower drift. You're talking about that it can be seen 7.5 miles away.
It had that piece of equipment is needed on the site no matter what. So no matter what volume is being produced, okay, that piece of equipment is necessary no matter what. So
and it produces the same amount at 27.5 versus 49.5 versus 55.
Right. So we anticipate to be 7.5 regardless.
Without a question, yes. So that would so if to be clear, that was at ultimate or at what we would envision as the largest potential build out. So the highest piece of equipment, the biggest piece of equipment that we think that, you know, would be potentially visible, that's what we modeled.
And, as I understood Mr. Prentice's explanation about the not the safety type of lights, but the lights for aviation reasons on the tower, it sounded an awful lot like one of the options we're working on here for light mitigation on wind farms, where it would be radar controlled and be non-operational unless an aircraft was in within a certain distance. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, the FAA will allow that. We would do the same thing.
But you don't have approval for that yet.
That's in the nature of an operating permit. I mean, we have to have construction lighting for, like, cranes and so forth, where you would not go through that process of getting an approval. But for the towers, yeah, if we can have aircraft lights that can turn off when there's nothing around, that'd be great.
I was trying to dig up something on that last night, and I wasn't able to come up with anything specific.
I don't think they've yet approved any applications like that, but we're going to keep an eye on it.
I might want to add, too, within a half a mile away, there is also a cell phone tower with the lights on it and what have you, too.
So with that in mind,
that's taller than these stacks significantly, correct?
With that in mind and with the commitment that you're going to use as few as possible, how many is that? How many would the FAA require from a minimum the towers?
I forget horizontally, but I think the only thing that we have that would require aircraft lights would be the crewed tower and the flare stack.
Right, and part of our team, several of them are aviation specialists, and so we'll have that specifically laid out with communications with the FAA to make sure that we're complying fully with what the requirements are.
Okay. Say that again. Two towers, did you say?
There's a flare stack for emergency use.
And then the main tower.
The crew tower, yeah.
Two. Yeah. Can you compare the lighting of this facility to, say, like Tesoro? Have you seen Tesoro lit up at night, something we're all familiar with?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Isn't it?
Beauty's in the eye of the beholder, Bill.
I know.
How will yours compare to that?
A tenth, maybe less.
Okay.
Yeah, it would cost a lot of money to go back through an older plant like that and replace it with downcast lights and the system that would allow you to turn them off when they're not used at all. So, you know, that's just the way they built refineries back then.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's a good comparison. So what about the odor? Usually they're kind of odorific. when you drive by Refinery. Yeah. What can you do to mitigate that, and are you doing anything to address that, or do you have plans to on this facility?
Those odors are things that we could sell. We're not going to have a plant that's going to be a leaky mess. That's a product that's going out into the air. Part of that is leak detection, you know, optical leak detection. Detects those types of hydrocarbons before they're detectable by the human nose. So those leaks will be fixed.
Is that regulated by health department at all, or the county?
Yeah. Well, fugitive emissions are regulated, yeah.
By the way, I'm still kind of defensive of the refinery that was in my legislative district till just a few years ago. That does not have the odors that the refinery had many decades ago anymore either. And
no.
They've really done a lot of work over there too. So I don't want to leave the impression to people who are listening like we have a terrible facility over here next door.
I don't smell it at Tesoro. I really don't. The only place I can think of is Laurel.
Please don't interpret my remarks as being critical, because that's a tough job to own and operate a plant like that.
They've done a nice job.
They do a great job. Yeah.
So I wanted to talk a bit more about the 49.5. That's kind of a new development that the company has stated, and it's still somewhat contradictory, but it is on your website at 49.5. That puts you under, you know, it puts you within the boundaries of the law. But it doesn't sit well with folks. I'm just going to be honest. It looks like you're just barely skirting the siting requirements. And that invites changes in the law. This is what happened with wind development. Companies would just go under, and then the threshold became lower and lower and lower. And so I have to ask again, have you thought about coming and going through the siting process? You've said you've done the studies. You have the information. Why wouldn't you just do it? Have the conversation with us, go through the permitting process, and do it right so you're free to go no matter how big you want to make it, or up to the size that it's sited at. Tell me why the company isn't going that route.
Well, the company, you really asked two questions. The company wants to build a 27,500 barrel per day plant. That's what we're going to do. The company is in the oil refining business. There is a possibility, not the plan, to expand the facility. It could expand in ways that increase throughput or not. I want to defer that until we are in operation and we decide which way this is going to go. Amongst other things, every issue that we've dealt with in permitting on air quality has been done by compiling information where every single piece of equipment has an emissions expectation. Every one of those is a probability estimate. They're very tight because we can go see what's in operation someplace. But seeing it all together in operation tells us a lot more about what this combination of technology looks like. The 49.5 came from saying, okay, we went through permitting at an upper bound of 55, back it off 10%. If we were to expand the plant up to that level, then you get about 10 feet away from the cliff before you go look over the edge, see what's going to happen. It's a matter of engineering conservancy. Also, as an operating company, we want to get the 27.5 in operation without further delay on permitting. We have investors to take care of, and we have people that want to go to work out there. If we get that in operation and decide to expand it, and that expansion would take the shape of improvements to the plant and increases in throughput to get anywhere near your threshold, you're going to see a siting application from us. That's when it becomes a plan and not a possibility.
Is it accurate to say you're still seeking capital for the project, or has that been secured?
It's secured conditional upon final permit to construct and our various commercial arrangements.
When you were out pitching the project to potential investors, I understand it's always important to tell them that there is potential growth. Nobody wants to park money in an investment that is stagnant. They want to see growth long term. They want to know there's long term growth potential. So I understand that. How much of that was framed up in terms of looking at the upside potential to the plant when you were out? Because, you know, that really is the burning question. The most significant question continues to be the numbers are all over the place. And Adam, as mentioned, I have no doubt you've got your work cut out for you in terms of making that number a little bit cleaner. But kidding aside, because this is really a serious component in terms of why we're here today, I see figures of $1 billion in terms of plant cost. Then I see figures of $800 million. Then I see figures of $850 million. And they're all very recent. And you would think that would coincide with the size of the facility, whether it's a 55,000 barrel or a 27.5 plus, potentially a 27.5 or a 27.5 plus another 22,000 after that. And that's where the questions, I think, understandably keep popping up for myself and others. They're not consistent. $1 billion to me would suggest a figure attached more to align more closely with a 55 or even 60,000 barrel refinery. Just looking at it from a proportional standpoint, I don't understand the dynamics, the economics in terms of what a refinery actually costs to build. But that's where, you know, we've asked a lot of questions over the past hour and a half, really questions that would be more commonly asked in an actual siting case about visual effects, et cetera, transportation, that type of thing. But really, at the end of the day, can you just try and frame something up that I can get my arms around a little bit better in terms of, you know, I understand, okay, the 10% cut to get it to 49.5, but
well,
why the shift?
Sure, on the capital side, it's a bit more complicated, but, you know, keep in mind that we started this company during a period of time when there was no such thing as venture capital for a conventional energy company. If you had a new electric car or a windmill or something like that, then people in Silicon Valley would shower you with money. So we were left to our own devices, and there are documents out there that are all over the map. But that's not a matter of hype. It's more of a disclosure item. If you're going to spend people's money, you got to tell them, yeah, there's a possibility that we're going to spend some of this money on looking at expansion of the plant. We've also had to tell people that we're now looking at other locations, too, Texas and Oklahoma, for a similar facility. Those are all disclosure items. Then when I'm talking to the press, and I am not surrounded by lawyers, and people ask me what the ultimate capital could be for the plant. And so whatever the maximum that we're thinking of at the time, those are the numbers we come up with. So, yeah, that's my fault. And, you know, maybe I'll have to wear a shock collar with Adam nearby if I start to talk about some of this stuff. But the fact is, yeah, if we went up to, you know, 49.5 or 52, that would be a, you know, $850 million capital investment, requiring total capital of well over $1 billion. So those numbers are consistent with a somewhat larger plant. What we're talking about building here, what my plan is to get the permit, close financing, start construction on 27.5. That's the capital we will have for that specific project.
One thing I'm just not understanding, I suppose maybe a lot of people don't, since there hasn't been a full-scale refinery built for so long, but how many are a lot of the components of a refinery kind of off-the-shelf things, and let me explain what I mean by that. With gas generation facilities, we site them if they're 50 megawatts. There have been a whole bunch go up at 45, and it appears like they're just building them small enough so they don't have to get siting. But the fact of the matter is it's a common design, and they buy these components, and it just happens to be that you go to that company, and they're kind of almost pre-manufactured and go and set it up. Right. And so with the refinery, why 27.5? Is there certain things, and with the future potential expansion of another 27.5, why isn't it 25 and 25 or 30 and 30? Are there pre-made parts of this that snap into place, or is that just numbers you've picked out based on market and capital availability?
No, a refinery is a little bit more complicated than a power facility. You know, running a refinery is like buying a latte and trying to separate it back into cream and coffee and water. And, you know, everybody's going to address it differently. the reason we picked 27.5 is some of our team had previously worked on a facility down in Houston on the ship channel that was at 25,000 barrels per day. The design of that crude tower, when you simulate running Bakken crude through it, actually can get you to 27.5. So that became our first Lego, if you will, for the project, that crude tower. And we added to that. Now, this refinery is not a topping unit, so, you know, you have choices. Oil has too much carbon in it, so you either figure out how to get rid of carbon or how to add hydrogen. So we're adding hydrogen. We have two hydrotreaters and what is called a reformer. And that's pretty expensive gear, but that gives you finished product at the end. So it's not a topping unit. It's a full conversion refinery. And, you know, we talk a lot about how clean it is, but it's really an accomplishment to figure out how to get a minimum economic size for a project like that down this low. That and being clean, I think, is going to also change the industry. So, you know, the sizing components build off of that crude throughput at 27.5. Now, we were asked by the Air Quality Division to go ahead and throw into our air permit what it would look like as an upper bound. We just doubled the crude tower. And, you know, so you end up with 55. That's how sophisticated that decision was.
So the a plant that was already, or a refinery that was already operational at 27.5, an expansion could be another 10,000 barrels, or it could be 20,000, or it could be 27.5, or it could be any number that the market was calling for?
Well, what you end up doing when you go into operation on a plant like that is you begin to look for areas where engineering conservancy led you to improper matching of different types of equipment, so you debottleneck the plant. So, yeah, within a year or so after the 27.5, we might just by, you know, changing out pumps here and there be up to 30. You know, at the same time, we have to go through a process of fixing our market up to where that additional product will go out. I mentioned earlier, one of the problems with Bakken crude is at this level, we get a lot of residual out of it. Now, Bakken is also very high paraffin crude, which means your opportunities for lubricating oils are there. There are firms that specialize in that end of the barrel, and so as we get into operation, we'll take a look at that. But, yeah, every plant is different. I mean, look at the evolution of the Mandan plant over time.
And so something I read a long time ago, maybe it was 2 years ago or so, indicated that this was going to be, well, that it was a 55,000 barrel a day facility, and that there was a first stage of 27.5, and then followed immediately by the increase of another 27.5. It seemed more like a situation where we can only build so much at a time. We'll get this part operational, start having some revenues and such, and continue on with getting our whole plan into effect, as opposed to, no, 27.5 is what we want, but the health department just asked us to throw something else in, so we doubled it and came up with that randomly. This sounded very specific, like it was one project built in two phases with dates included as to when they would, the plan was to start and complete them. Can you address that?
Well, I don't want to blame the health department, but the 55 is essentially double what we start out with. The plan to expand is going to be dependent upon capital. So that is not really a plan. That's a possibility at this point. Also, with the additional engineering we've done over the last 5 months, just getting a bigger plant is not necessarily the most profitable thing for us to do. There are other possibilities here. So, you know, yes, we have made a lame attempt in the past to reconcile what we're doing as far as going forward with the project and make that consistent with our permit applications and so forth. But, again, let me be clear. Our current plan is 27.5. Whatever we do after that will depend on the market, and particularly the capital markets.
That said, and you know, you're well within the law to build at 27.5 without a siting permit. You've hired one of the attorneys in North Dakota who is most familiar with our siting process, and our siting process. It sounds like you've done a lot of the studies, et cetera, that would need to go into an application. You could do it 3 to 6 months. You could be done with the siting process. So, again, I'm going to implore you, just go through the siting process. I don't see why you wouldn't do that. Is it a cost thing? Is it a time thing? Is it the public scrutiny? What is it that when you're contemplating so publicly going beyond the siting threshold that would make it jurisdictional, and you know you're in a sensitive area, why not just come forward and go through the siting process?
Well, I guess my response would have to be that for the plant that we intend to build now, we believe we have complied with the applicable siting process. I understand that you would like to take a formal look at this project, and you may have an opportunity to. But, you know, in the private sector, we very seldom look for excuses to have another regulatory layer on what we're trying to do. That's not something we contemplated just because it would be of interest to you to look at it.
So you've completely ruled out the possibility of going through the siting?
No. We are going to comply with the law. You will probably see a siting certificate application from us at some point in the future.
And you mentioned a few minutes ago that you're looking at other locations in other states for this facility?
This type of facility.
Is that in addition to this facility or in exchange for this?
In addition.
Oh, in addition.
Is the project, potential project in Texas, does that mirror this project or is it a different type of refinery?
Well, it's very similar. I mean, the business model is clean refineries, niche markets, something that can be done as a minor source. There are several places in the nation that could satisfy those requirements.
Mm-hmm. And that project's a 50,000-barrel refinery, correct?
It could be quite a bit more. That's a different market. I mean, you probably read a lot of the news lately about the product going into Mexico.
Is that a one-phase project or a two-phase project? Or beyond three?
Could be three or four. Depends on capital.
So build it in chunks as well. It wouldn't be 50 out of the gate?
Again, you know, the Permian crude is very similar to Bakken crude in many respects. So the same basic configuration for a crude unit would be the starting building block. you have people that fabricate these things that are very good at it, so you don't want them doing four at a time. You do them one after the other.
I'm kind of jumping. Seems like a lull here, so I want to jump to a little bit different subject. Can you describe on the map about where the pipeline is, the incoming pipeline?
It would be from the corner of the yellow. It would be about 100 yards off of that.
Oh, thanks, Greg.
Which corner?
Northwest corner of the site.
Okay.
The Bakken link is about 100 yards off of that.
And that's going to that Freiburg station?
Yes.
And
That's one possibility.
Greg, are you talking right?
There are four different gathering systems, including one that we would build, or the firm that would supply us would build a extensive line from the north down directly to the refinery. But, you know, there are lines through along 94 and north and south on either side of us that we can tie into.
Does it cross this property? Would a pipeline have to be built from that to this facility? Even a short one?
Yeah.
There's gathering systems, though, all over that area.
Yes.
So further east, there would be gathering systems that you could tie into as well as the rail.
What we like is the fact that there are several, and that gets us into different areas of the Bakken.
From a supply standpoint?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I would venture to guess that there's a lot of different sites that would offer that same possibility. Maybe more limited along the rail system. I don't know. We don't permit the gathering systems, but there's an awful lot of pipes in the ground all over in that western part. Mr. Chairman, I don't have any more questions. Perhaps you do, you and Brian do.
No, I think I'm pretty well covered too, Brian.
I've asked some of the questions, of course, along the way.
While you're checking over, I did miss maybe a couple. An expansion from 27.5 to something significantly more in the future. Would that require additional property, or is this diagram show enough property to even double a 27.5?
We're occupying a very small portion of that property. So, yes, it would all be within that property.
Did you have another question, Randy?
Not right now, anyway.
Okay. Well, it appears we're getting close to the end. This is probably, you know, the two issues that I had mentioned early on. One just the trying to get my arms around the numbers that we've talked extensively about, so I don't have to dive back into that. Just moving around so much between, you know, above the threshold, below the threshold costs are really not a matter that I'm terribly interested in, because that's between you and the investment community to make the project go. But I'm just looking at it from a proportional standpoint. But the other part would be, and this will continue to occur in western North Dakota in particular, as the oil and gas industry continues to grow. And that is, how do you balance public interests while respecting private landowner rights and not infringing upon those rights and trying to get to the right balance in all of this? And it's a challenge, and I doubt that we will ever see perfection when it comes to that. I don't know that it could possibly exist. We strive for perfection, but we live in an imperfect world. We live in a world that continues to be heavily powered and reliant on fossil fuels. Will that shift and change as time goes on? We'll see. We'll see a change in that regard as more renewables come online. But for now, we live in a carbon fuel-based world. That's just the reality. So I appreciate the fact that you came in and answered some of the questions. It seems like whenever you do something like this, you probably walk away with as many questions as you walked in with. And that just means we're thinking about it, you know, from every angle. So I suspect I will have a few follow-up questions that I would pose, and nothing immediate right now. And if there was, I would certainly do it in as public a venue and transparent a way as possible. But for now, that's it for me in terms of what I have.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. And I mean, from the challenge from my perspective, from the private perspective, is trying to make sense of various areas of law and regulation and plan a business accordingly. And, you know, for a project of this size, we had been thinking we've done a pretty good job, but it's obviously not a perfect job. It's not a perfect process. I have no objection to coming back periodically to talk about the project if you want us to. You know, the questions that arose probably would not have become significant questions if we'd have been in here more frequently on a personal basis and not just exchanging letters. So whatever you would like to do there is fine.
Anything else from staff that you had questions before we wrap up? Okay. Then if anybody from the company has any final comments, and then the commissioners will, and we'll wrap up for the day. But is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, just thank you for letting us come in to talk to you.
I would just say that we hope you found this useful. I know that we've tried to be responsive to your questions by way of letter, but I think this was a more efficient way of getting to all your questions. I can imagine if some of the questions would have come by letter, we would have responded, which would have precipitated more questions. So hopefully you found this helpful, and echo Mr. Prentice's remarks that if you have more questions down the road, please don't hesitate to invite us to come back.
Closing comments?
No, I think I inadvertently made my closing comments. Other than the final comment would be, I certainly understand the aesthetic beauty of the Badlands. I've been attracted to the Badlands, and I spend a lot of time out there at a ranch that I have south of Sentinel Butte. So I completely understand whether it's the national park or just the Badlands in general. They are a very special place, and on one hand, you want to see economic development occur. It's good for the state. It's good for the economy. It's good for counties, and we need that type of growth. But on the other hand, you like to preserve the very special places that we have in this world as well, and it's a tough juggling act, no doubt about it. But thank you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
One of the things in 5 years that I've noticed here is that sometimes we go through painstaking details in establishing not only all the evidence and cases, but a lot of details about whether something is jurisdictional or not. And we look at it with the same seriousness, whether it's something that seemingly from what you get in the press or from comments that come into this commission that nobody cares about, or something that really a lot of people care about. This is one, it's no secret that a lot of people care about. This room is full. There's been things in the press for many months now, so it's something that a lot of people care about. Our decisions are pretty much all things that can be appealed into court. So even us making a decision isn't necessarily the end of it, although I will say with a fair amount of pride that we have a tremendous track record of having our decisions affirmed by the courts. So there is that. But I think because of the amount of concern that is out there in the public, because of things that were said by company officials to the press that will be at least suggested as evidence, I fully expect that when you break ground, someone is going to bring a complaint case that this is in violation of the Siting Act. And that then we're going to be back here making a jurisdictional decision with evidence presented on the record and sworn testimony. And that if we decide that it's jurisdictional and you have to stop construction, that the company will appeal it to court. And if we decide that it is non-jurisdictional, that someone else will appeal it to court. And in either case, you could be holding yourselves up from construction for a long time, regardless what we would decide in that case. But I don't think it's any secret that that's a possibility of what could play out here. I will say for my own thinking at this point, I wish we had probably had this opportunity to visit earlier. I found this helpful. It's answered some questions and to me about why the numbers have evolved over time. But I expect we'll ultimately be back here in a jurisdictional situation.
Thank you, Randy. I'll kind of add to what your final comments were, and that is to say thanks again for being here and for sharing information. I learned a lot more about the plans than, you know, trying to figure it out online and through letters, et cetera. So that was very helpful. Just like Greg was saying, through the county process, where over that, through that public process, people became to know about the project and understand it better and have their fears mitigated, and you probably gained support through that process. I believe the same would be true with ours. It's a proven process. It's very transparent. It works, and it's not real onerous. So I know you don't have to do it, but I think there's a lot of compelling reasons why you should, and I urge you again to seriously consider coming through for through the siting process. I think you could alleviate yourself some problems in the long run by doing that on the front end, a little bit of extra time perhaps, but I think in the long run it would be much better for you as a company to have completed that process, and I think it'll save you trouble. So thank you, though, for being here. You've gone above and beyond in so many ways with this project. I think you should also do it on the siting and come to us for the siting permit. So thank you for your time, and I appreciate your willingness to come forward and talk to us again as the project proceeds. And again, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you again. We'll close this meeting.